For years now, David Simon and Eric Overmyer have been dramatizing the rebirth of New Orleans after Katrina on their HBO series, Tremé. The power of Tremé, and in rebirth stories like these, Simon and Overmyer says, is how the past and the future mix right before your eyes. And they say the story of recovery in New Orleans is both heroic, but it's also like each person's deal with the devil, a deal so they can individually survive.
I always think of that famous scene, to me famous, in Chinatown where Jack Nicholson's character says, well, you know, he's corrupt, but, you know, we all have to swim in the same sea.
That's exactly right. I mean, the third season of the show, the first season we depicted the people coming back after the near death of New Orleans. The second season, the problems, all the attendant problems of New Orleans came back as you would expect. And the third season, some money and some opportunity. But as you point out, those things in this country and with our way of doing things, they come with certain strings attached. Certain deals have to be accepted or walked away from.
It's a great line in the first episode of this season, I think, where somebody says to, I believe it's the reporter who arrives, welcome to New Orleans, it's a different world. Is that what you've discovered in doing this series, that it is a fundamentally different world?
Well, it's a pretty interesting place. It is and it isn't. I mean, it's an American city, but it's also unlike any other American city as well. And talk about swimming in the same sea. I mean, up until the storm, for sure, corruption was sort of laughed at. You know, it's just the way things got done. And I think there's one of the good things that's come from the storm is that it's not funny anymore. Corruption was right at the center of the levees and the flood protection system failing with substandard construction and graft and all that sort of thing. So I think it's, you know, back when Edwin Edwards was the governor, and he ran against David Duke. Do you remember that?
Yeah,
election?
Sure. Yeah. Sure.
Well, the bumper sticker around town was "Vote for the crook." It's important. Huh. And I had one of those bumper stickers, and we all kind of laughed about it. Edwin was charming and amusing, but not so much anymore since the storm.
So, in a land of so many costumes and masks, Katrina has managed to blow away the masks, especially of corruption. And there's a different sort of level of awareness of the usual way of doing business.
I'm not sure it's blown away the corruption, but certainly the cost is now more apparent. But I think a very telling moment was, you know, they elected a new mayor, and there are a lot of hopes still, I think, around Mitch Landrieu. And some things may have changed for the better, but very tellingly, one of the worst aspects of life in New Orleans is they have one of the most there's no other way to say it, one of the most corrupt and violent police departments. I mean, it's under federal court order at this point. It's one of the few large American cities where they're reporting to a federal court because of their problems.
And that's a good thing.
And that's a good thing.
Improvement.
That's
a mm-hmm.
That's an improvement. But, when Mitch came in, there was an opportunity. New mayor, go outside, find yourself a Bratton, find yourself somebody from another agency that is beholden to nobody in New Orleans, and for the love of God, clean house. You have one of the worst police departments in the country. Instead, they got a fellow who had a long history in New Orleans to come back from Memphis. And so things like the problem with detailed officers and secondary employment and that becoming this sort of cesspool of corruption, within a matter of a few short months, it was clear that the chief's brother-in-law was brokering that. I mean, it doesn't go away merely because everyone becomes aware. But as Eric says, it became less charming. It became less the source of story and song and wit, and more about this is why things don't work down here.
And it makes for more interesting stories. I'm amazed at the level to which you can convey the sense of place in New Orleans, not simply in the background of the pretty pictures, but in the foreground. In the dialogue, I mean, we are so close to the food and the music and all of these other things that you've talked about. And it seems very, very deliberate. It's not just something in the background of the credit shots.
Well, that's one of the things we were worried about when we first started talking about doing the show. We wanted desperately to do a show that was that accurately conveyed New Orleans, that it had never been done. And one of the questions was, can you convey New Orleans? So we've really strived for authenticity in the dialogue and in the facts we've presented as well.
And here's an example question. What is this scene about here?
Red pickled pears. Contrasts come together on the plate to make a balance. And the soul of the dish, glace de viande.
Chef, you need to get into character.
Oh, man.
There's a time to cook, there's a time to sell. Now, we're not going to be able to open before Mardi Gras, but we still got to keep the wheels greased.
Now, that's about New Orleans foodies, but it's also about the sort of Grim Reaper there in the background. What's going on in that scene?
Oh, well, that's...
go ahead.
I think I can place that one.
Yeah.
That is in advance of the restaurant, the new restaurant opening for the character Ginetta Sattel, and she's talking with her backer, who is the money behind and the power behind getting this thing up and running. And they are now trying to get her to a media consultant and do the prep work on her because they're trying to get her the maximum possible attention in a way that is very un-New Orleanian. They're trying to get her some national prominence for coming back to New Orleans. And so that scene is actually in prep of – she's actually in the kitchen. She's doing what she loves. She's training her new kitchen staff to do the actual work of creating food and feeding people, and that's what she loves. But it's time to go get in her. They're hoping to get her a spot on Good Morning America.
And there's a tension in a lot of the scenes between what's required of you in New Orleans as a musician or cook, and what's required of you on the national stage. And that's partly what that scene
is
about.
There's a reason a lot of New Orleans talent over the last century has had to go elsewhere.
Or they've stayed.
But again, that's a huge choice.
And it's in the dialogue. Yeah. I mean, you will have somebody talking about which tool to use to put up drywall, and they will lapse in the next line into, Wynton Marsalis doesn't know what he's talking about. He don't know jazz. I know jazz.
Yeah.
That's very present both in your dialogue and, as you discovered, in the sort of conversation and tension in New Orleans culture.
It's an ongoing thing. You know, New Orleanians are extremely proud of their culture and very defensive and not confident in it as well.
Yeah, it's a very strange thing because it is so unique, and yet they do feel they have that second-tier city thing going on in spades. I mean, I'm familiar with it from Baltimore, but you know, it's a combination of great pride and a great chip on your shoulder all at the same time.
I mean, it's like the whole city is like High Fidelity. It's a bunch of aficionados talking about obscure music in
Absolutely.
Ways that you cannot understand.
Obscure
but if you're
music,
in it, it's
obscure
unbelievable.
Cuisine. You know, who makes the best gumbo?
Besides my mama,
that's
the first answer. Besides your mama, who makes the best gumbo?
It's a floor fight.
That's a floor fight.
Wisdom about New Orleans from Eric Overmyer and David Simon, co-creators of the HBO series Tremé, talking about this third season, which begins this week, and we're all very excited about that. Explain here what's going on in this scene, because here you've created a kind of maybe an Odysseus character, maybe a Jack Nicholson character, in the sense that here's somebody coming into a situation that they have really no ability to understand, yet they doggedly, as a reporter, an independent reporter whose means of support is not even clear, I think in the script he's described as a ProPublica reporter, he's trying to get to the bottom of a crime. Listen.
This is a postmortem arson with an accelerant having been used. A trained pathologist should consider this a probable homicide, and he would be telling police to begin a full-bore investigation.
Will you say that on record?
I'd said it then, I'll say it now.
That is predicated on the actual story of A.C. Thompson for ProPublica and The Nation magazine, who broke the story of the New Orleans police slaying and then the burning of the body of Henry Glover. And we actually depicted the work that A.C. Thompson did in the context of that case, because that case was an essential linchpin in what ultimately became, finally, after many years' delay, the federal prosecutions for questionable deaths during and after the storm.
But visually, you show what he's up against. I mean, he gets such a headwind at all levels.
It's actually, you know, the one thing that I don't like about the drama of or the melodrama of anything that's ever been a repertorial story on television or in film is everything clicks a little too easily, and the truth seems to have a power all its own. The more terrifying thing about modern journalism and the sort of the state of our society now is that sometimes journalism and the truth doesn't have quite the power you think it's going to have. He does actually, in that scene, acquire real good information about how they ditched the legitimate autopsy of Henry Glover.
But he's talking to an out-of-state
pathologist.
Right. He had to go out of state because New Orleans coroner said just ruled it
undetermined.
Yeah.
So he takes what he learns and he flies all the way back to New Orleans, and it only goes so far. It's met with a collective institutional yawn, and that was the case. And by the way, for New Orleanians, that was the case for years and years, not just on the issue of crime or corruption in their police department, but on what was happening with the housing money and the road home money. And, you know, there's a theme throughout Tremé that we've been building on, that we've been trying to depict accurately, which was after the storm, after the near death of the city, those people were basically on their own. And they learned that over a period of months and years that, you know what, no one's riding to the rescue here, not political leadership, not economic imperative, not anything. It's us. It's down to community and what we have in our own bag of tricks. And the only weapons they had really were community and culture. Those were the only things that actually worked for New Orleans, the only thing that brought the city back.
Are you guys on some artistic level part of the rescue squad?
No.
Even a little?
Maybe a little.
I guess.
Really? I think we've done some good with the musicians and the music.
We've sent some checks to musicians for performance and for songwriting.
Maybe a little bit. I mean, I'd be happy to be part of the communal uplift of New Orleans.
I'll be happy if they invite me to the party now and then.
Well, David Simon and Eric Overmyer, thanks so much.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Co-creators of the HBO series Tremé, which opens this weekend.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.